The title of the talk is Cittopassana. Subtitle, Sitting by the Stream of Mind and Heart. And citta is a word that you can translate as mind-heart. And it's interesting that there isn't in the East as a whole, but certainly in the Buddhist world, a real difference or a real separation here. That there's mind here above and heart and body below. There's a nice story about a Tibetan monk that was being tested in the laboratory while he was meditating. And the laboratory people put lots of sensors on them all over his head and checking brain waves. And I've had that quite a few times at the Weizmann and the Tel Aviv University. They've had the same treatment. And checking his brain as he was meditating. And he started to laugh and laugh and laugh. And the researchers said, "Why are you laughing?" He said, "Well, you're putting all the sensors, the cheshanim, you're putting them in the wrong place." I said, where should we put them?" He said, "Here, of course." "Not here." He said, "Nothing. Here is where it's all happening." So I really want to just, in a way, go over again what Jonathan said this morning and expand it a bit, but really kind of go into the same material because it's interesting, it's important, and it's really helpful to understand more and more about this mind and this heart that are all the time controlling us. And we'll start with the mind and talking about controlling. There is this phrase that says, thought is a great servant, but a bad master. And I think that that's kind of a bottom line here, that our natural freedom shouldn't be held hostage by thought or by mood and feeling. They're there, we can enjoy them, we can be with them, we can flow with them, we can, but they can be bad masters. And the truth is, as we know, that thought has immense power, huge power. A thought that's shared by a group can create a war and kill endless people because of a thought, a view, which is a thought, a story. It can be bringing huge benefit and joy, and it's very powerful, a thought, because it's believed in as being truth and identified with as being what I am and what the world is. And we forget that a thought is a story, and it seems it seems like a very important story. If we look up at the night sky and see the stars above us and wonder what's there and what is there, it feels a lot more than a story. It feels something really amazing. And that is the power of mind. The mind is, can watch the stars and can build a jumbo jet and can do amazing things, there's no doubt. But it can also cause us immense trouble and difficulty and pain and slavery. thoughts that oppress us, machshavot tardaniyot, thoughts that make us anxious and afraid and critical and irritated and unpleasant and obsessive, and bring us again and again to psychologists that can't solve the problem, and or psychiatrists. So it's huge power in thought. The picture, the traditional picture of thought, is a monkey. And the reason is that the monkey jumps from branch to branch, and it catches a branch, and then it catches the next branch, and then it catches the next branch. And this is very much what thought does. It catches something, and then it goes to the next thing, which is connected to what it just was catching, which is close to it, and then it catches something else which is close to that, and it goes on and it goes on. And the Pali word papancha expresses this sense of every thought making more of itself. Every thought brings another, and this one brings another, and brings another, and brings another, and brings another. And the image I always have in my mind, the picture I have in my mind, is when Winnie the Pooh had a party. I think he had a party for Christopher Robin, I can't remember. But he invited Rabbit, and Rabbit invited others, and they all, each one brought friends and relations. And there was a picture in the little book that I used to, when I was a child, sort of very old book. There was a wonderful picture of all the people coming to the party, the Rabbit and all the friends and relations, and they got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, like all the beetles and the insects and so on, and kind of line of creatures all joining the party. And that's our mind, you know, the line and chains of papancha thinking all joining the party. On and on and on, down to the smallest little tail that's over there, it's still coming, and then it brings more and it brings more. And we tend to forget that thought is like a wave on the ocean of awareness. We tend to be so busy with what the story is that we forget that thought is awareness. But it's awareness like the ocean packed into a bottle. We take the ocean and pour it into a bottle, and that's a thought, or a wave. And we forget that it's made of awareness, not made of anything else other than awareness. So we forget that, because we're really so, in our life, so totally occupied with form. And the Buddha said, form, namely, this form is busy with form. What is born is busy with birth. What dies is busy with dying. What we are, we identify ourselves as a form, so we only see forms. And we don't see beyond the form. And it's quite a challenge, as we're doing here, to actually see beyond the form. And a thought is a classic form. It's a package. What's it made of? The ocean. Awareness, unlimited, collected into form. And it's shaped by conditions and conditioning. And then it arises in a completely uncontrollable way. We actually don't really design our thoughts. They tend to arise because of conditioning, conditions, situations, responses, circumstances, and they just arise. And this is why in Buddhist psychology, thought is one of the senses. it's not separate from sense, a sense, especially memories and so on. Content arising in the mind is a bit like sound arriving to the ears, which just comes because of conditions. The muezzin at 12 o'clock on a Friday begins to do his Dhamma talk. Some of us may not like it. Some of us may like it. We're not in control of it. It does things to us. We react. We respond. But we're not in control of it. If it disturbs us, the disturbance is here, not there. We become disturbed, but we are in charge of it is disturbance, because that's what we do with the reaction. The sound is just a sound. The muezzin, 12 o'clock, does his thing. So a thought is like that. It arises, it may disturb us, it may not disturb us. We respond to it, and we give it weight and importance and truth. It may be, we can just see it's a story. As soon as we sit and meditate, it's the time when we begin to feel we can see thought. Generally, we don't see thought. Generally, we just act from thought. We thought arises and we act, or we speak, or we write, or we go to the makolet. We're not usually looking at thought. So those of you, and there's most of you maybe, and most of us maybe, who feel we are pretty well drowned in waves of thought, don't forget that for you to know that, you're already meditating. For you to be able to see the cacophony inside, the noise in the mind, you have to be sitting and meditating. So just don't despair if when you look inside you see this cacophony, this noise, this endless chattering monkey mind jumping from branch to branch endlessly and inviting all its friends and relations and rabbit and and you think, what the hell is this? It means you're meditating. So, I want to introduce something which is important, and in the context of this retreat, we haven't been giving it a lot of importance simply because we can't do everything at one go. I already feel very often in a retreat that there's been far, far, far too much stuff coming from the Bama here. In so many instructions, so much Dharma, so much images, so much teachings, and it often feels like overwhelming. Thankfully, one aspect of our mind, our thought, is that we forget nearly everything. So we can leave the retreat and we may remember a tiny bit of all those wonderful Dhamma talks. That's fine. That's a natural cleaning process. But one thing we don't talk about and we didn't talk about, and I would like to add now, is something which is a little bit different from what you've been doing here. And that is the fact that there is a place for being active in changing the climate inside. And this is different from what you've been receiving up to now and what we've been talking about. What we've been talking about and busy with is the ability to actually hold in awareness, the content of our mind. We haven't done much about changing it. But I do want to say that this is really a big story inside the Buddhist world. But it's not just our work to free ourselves from the stories and feel free in the stories, but also to change the story to something which is more helpful, more useful, more kind, less giving us trouble, less painful, less conflict, reducing suffering. And there's a lot of teaching about this. So, at this point, I just want to suggest five. It's a sutta, a text, which describes five ways of changing thought. And it really is here a little different from what you've been doing. It's actually repainting the picture. It's redoing the stories, not just looking at them. It's kind of more in the realm of psychology, in a way. The first in the text is actually replacing unhelpful, unwholesome, wholesome in the Pali is akusala, and unwholesome is akusala, means not very healthy, not nutrition, doesn't feed us or others, is akusala. Kusala is what feeds us. A very strong concept, especially in the monastic world, the Buddhist monastic world, very strong, and loads of texts about this. So the first way is simply replacing unhelpful, unwholesome thought with wholesome and helpful thought. The truth is, we have been doing it, but we haven't been describing it in this way. One of the things that we're doing every evening is replacing difficult thoughts, tiring thoughts, chaotic thoughts, with thoughts of kindness. And every evening there's been a meditation that actually brings specific content into the mind. Every evening we've been doing it. The content is kindness. The content is appreciation. The content is being soft with ourselves and not critical. So it's changing the picture, and it's different from the practice we're doing most of the day. And but helpful. Inviting deeper truth is replacing chaotic thoughts just of planning the future, what I'm going to do next Thursday, with thoughts of Dharma, of wisdom, or with thoughts of letting things go. It's replacing. That's the first of the tools. Second one is reflecting on, if I go here, then what would happen? It's an interesting sutta that the Buddha gave to his son, Rahula, when Rahula was around 7 years old. And actually, maybe it's the second. Karen, do you remember? Where he gave Rahula advice on reflecting on the outcome of his actions. It's the second one, when he's a bit older, right?
No, the first one.
It's the first one I thought was about lies, lying and the bowl. Anyway, he gave to his son a long text, which is a reflection on the results. If you do this, examine what the results will be. If you think this, reflect on what will happen if I go down that road. If I go down that road of sinking in front of the TV the whole evening, what will be the result? Tiredness, fed up with politicians, pissed off generally with the world, and then going to bed like that. A small example, but this thought, switch on the TV, all of us have, where will it go? Or thought of conflict. I don't like this people, this neighbor, this person, this group, this other, those, them, whatever. Where does it take you, that thinking? So reflecting on the results of actions in the mind or of thoughts in the mind, that's a second big story about money, for example. If I'm thinking a lot about money, where will it take me? It's a small example. A third is to direct the attention somewhere else. So we're thinking about something, painful thoughts. Direct the attention to the hands. Direct the attention to the birds outside. Change the track. Direct the attention to something beautiful in our life. That's kind of moving the attention, shifting the attention. It's a bit different from the first one, which is rewriting the script. It's actually changing the shining light on another place in us. Well, it's similar to the first one, but it's a little different. The fourth tool is looking at the sources of thought and understanding the sources. Here is where, you know, the psychology, psychodynamic psychology clinic is full. If I understand the source of these thoughts, then I'll have some understanding, reflection, maybe something in my childhood, maybe some story that happened to me, maybe this is a source of things, that's a source of things. Understanding the source of things that are disturbing us or that are hard for us. And there is a wisdom in that, yeah, definitely. And it's one of the tools that is suggested. And the fifth tool is just simply pulling out the plug. Mutsiyata teka? Yasheka. Turn off the TV. Means sometimes it needs determination. A bit of being a bit of a hero. Just stopping it. Track. Well, we've done that. We've been suggesting that where you get caught in chains of thought, you use the breath. You just come to a place. The breath is a little bit like turning the attention somewhere else. But sometimes we can just say, stop. Enough. Or daikvar. I had enough. The party's over. Send all the rabbit and friends and relations, send them home. Had enough. And it needs sometimes decision, clarity, enough of this. So that's the fifth tool that's discussed. And interestingly enough, this particular sutta, what I like is every time one of these tools, when they are kind of psychological tools that are mentioned, it says at the end of the paragraph, the ketta, and then if you do this, the mind, it becomes quiet, it becomes steady, and it becomes focused. In other words, that although there is manipulation of the story, the end result is always the same, which is a mind that is more quiet, that is more steady, that is more focused. Never mind which tool you use, it all goes in the same direction. And here, I think, is where we find the music instead of the cacophony of the mind. Where we learn to play music rather than chaos and cacophony. Still the mind is talking, but it has more music. It's kusala. It's kusala. So it is helping. It is feeding us. It is our servant, not our master, and helping wisdom and quiet and steadiness. Nevertheless, what we have been doing is vipassana, and in the case of mind, citta vipassana, and vipassana is based on seeing thought as thought, and knowing especially the beginning and the ending of thought, how it arises, how it's there, and how it goes away. And it's not easy, because it needs us to stand back and have an aware mind that is able to look at thought. It is a bit like taking the point of view of the ocean, looking at its own waves. And I want to read a quote from Gunaratna Mahatera, who wrote really a classic book, which is being used until today. It's quite an old book, but it's beautifully written. It's called Mindfulness in Plain English, this book, and it's a very good practical text. And just listen to what he says about the practice. There is a difference between being aware of a thought and thinking a thought. And that difference is very subtle. It's primarily a matter of feeling or texture. A thought you are simply aware of with bare attention feels light in texture. There is a sense of distance between that thought and the awareness viewing it. It arises lightly, like a bubble, and it passes away without necessarily giving rise to the next thought in that chain. Normal conscious thought is much heavier in texture. It is ponderous. Ponderous is weighty. It is commanding. It is compulsive. In other words, it's the master. It sucks you in, and it grabs control of consciousness. By its very nature, it's obsessional, and it leads straight to the next thought in the chain, apparently with no gap between them. Conscious thought sets up a corresponding tension in the body, such as the muscles contracted or the heart is beating faster. You won't feel tension until it grows to actual pain, because normal conscious thought is also greedy. It grabs all your attention and leaves none to notice its own effect. The difference between being aware of the thought and thinking the thought is very real, but it is rather subtle and difficult to see. And concentration is one of the tools needed to be able to see this difference. So, a little bit repeating what Jonathan said this morning, looking at thought is the ocean looking at the wave. The main important aspect is non-identification. Not identifying. Lo vihistahut in a sipur. As a heart, very lowly he's done it, to identify, but not to be identified with, in English. To identify means to see it clearly, what it is. A thought of planning, what I'm going to do tomorrow, and the next day, and the next day, and the next, what I'm doing, what I need to do. A thought of judgment. I can't manage this, it's too difficult for me, I'm no good at this, I'm a terrible meditator, I have to do 20 retreats in order to actually watch my thought, I can't understand anything, blah blah. Judgmental thought, critical thought, desire thought, when are they going to give me some decent food? And a negative thought, there's so much disturbance, they don't turn on, the air conditioning is on at the wrong time and off at the wrong time, the muezzin is giving me a headache. Negative thought. Identifying thought, but not being identified with the thought, meaning being it. And there's a big difference. And respecting thought. We don't need to switch it off. We don't need to switch off thought. But give it respect. It's power. If used correctly, kusala, big power. Can change the world. So give it respect. I like the English word respect because it comes from the Latin. Re is again, and spec means to see. So respect is different from kavod. In English it means to look again. Not the first look. A second look. Not just a quick look, but a careful look. Respect. And as well in our practice, we are trying to, like we heard in this quote, the thoughts can feel light. And they can feel like bubbles. They can feel cloudy. They can feel made of nothing. And it's quite a shock. This story, which is dominating my whole life, for example, self-criticism, making me small, making me miserable, making me a failure in life, and when I look at it, it's just a bubble. Nothing. It's made of nothing. It's just a cloud passing by. It's amazing. Amazing. And it's such a freeing experience to be able to see that. This thought that's been controlling me all my life, what's it made of? It's a cloud. It's a wisp. It's nothing. It's empty. It comes and it goes. I wrote a poem about this, which I won't read at all, but I'll read a little bit of it. About thought. Weaving illusion out of pure light, arising from nothing, returning to nothing, and in between signifying the world. So raid the unknown, love the womb, not just the baby. And let the power of nothing reveal everything. If we look carefully at thought, we will also notice, just like in the quote before, it's always associated with feeling. The mind and the heart are always together. There really isn't a thought that is completely neutral, that has no heart in it. But we have to define heart a little bit more carefully. Heart is the driving power. It drives us. We respond to life through heart. But we also look for what's interesting through the heart. So what drives thought is actually feeling. What's interesting for us? The mind doesn't know it. The mind goes where the heart is telling it. The heart says, what's interesting to me is having lots of thoughts that I'm no good. Or someone else is no good. That's interesting. So the mind goes there. Or if the heart says, what's interesting is a great cup of tea. I'm going right now to the tea corner. And then, oh, no milk, no sugar, no... oh, so the mind is being driven by the interests are the interests of the heart. Liking, not liking, pushing, pulling, go here, go there, this is interesting, this is not, this is relevant, this is not, this is helpful, this is not. That's the heart talking very subtly, driving the engine of the mind. And it's always there. And we can often feel a thought creating, just like he said in the quotation, movement in the body. A little movement, a little interest, a little quickening of the heart, a little contraction in the tummy. The body and the mind are together and the heart is together. We're really one being. All of these energies are one. And the heart and the mind are together. I read somewhere that the normal background state of the brain is a mild anxiety. The scientists sort of reporting that the normal state of the normal mind, the background state, the ground state, is anxiety. So you can't say that the mind is just a machine. The anxiety is also driving us. A little bit like, I can understand it, like, what will happen? It's anxiety. But I need to know. I'm afraid of unknown. I need to know who I am. What will happen? So mild anxiety. So that the mind is being driven by mild anxiety is like saying, yeah, there's emotion, feeling all the time, even in the background state of the mind and the brain. And these delicate feelings are like all the time there with us, and they can be responding to liking and to pleasant and unpleasant, creating liking and not liking. And then they can get more powerful and become emotion. An emotion is more powerful than delicate feelings. And the reason is the emotion collects together a lot of power in the body and in the mind. When there's emotion, the heart is really touched. The body is changed. The blood circulates in a different way. The hormones are kind of bubbling. The mind is going mea kamash, 100 miles an hour. in all kinds of directions. You think of the anger, how that really recruits Magayas, all the energies of the body and the mind and the blood and the muscles and everything. Because it collects everything together, emotions are very, very powerful, and we simply may not be able to see them clearly enough. Our mindfulness may not be strong enough to be able to see emotion. And just kind of, it's good to know that, and not to feel, oh, I failed because my anger, I can't look at it, it's too strong, it just takes me over, overwhelms me. So therefore I'm not practicing, I'm no good at this meditation business. But we forget that we need to look at it more carefully and realize that emotion can be very strong. And our mindfulness may be here, and the emotion is here. But we do need a few more retreats, and then it'll be there, and then we'll be all right. Emotion also will tend to have a stronger karma around it. Karma means it makes bigger waves for us and for others. The waves are bigger. So it can get us into more trouble, or if there are very positive emotions, it can get us out of trouble. But they have more results. And one of the ways that we can wisely look at feeling or at emotion is knowing that the emotions are made of many parts of the whole being, and we can begin to take it to pieces. In other words, not to try and look at the whole angry person in one go with our limited tools of mindfulness, but to take an aspect of the emotion, such as the feeling in the tummy, just that, or the heat in the body, or the beating of the heart, or a certain kind of story in the mind, or the pain that we feel of anxiety or fear or anger. And just that for us can be a handle, can be a place where we can actually catch with mindfulness and look at the emotion through this limited window, and still it will work. Because we're still looking at the emotion, but we contracted it down to, it's like on the computer, we made minimize the whole program into a small icon, which is still the anger, but it's limited, and we can then deal with it. We can be with it, we can stay with it, we can watch it, as you heard both from Karen, from Jonathan, to recognize the emotion, to be with it, to let it flower and let it die away with the eye of awareness. There isn't a quick fix for emotion. But this sense of not stopping emotion, not fighting it, not believing it, not putting it up on the stage, and not stopping it, but not feeding it, one of those, just allowing it to naturally flower up, grow up, and die away in its own way, with awareness, that's enough. It works, and slowly and slowly the emotion gets less. When I first came to Israel, I remember, I was amazed to see how everyone was saying, It's very good to express anger. It's very helpful to express your anger. You should express it more and express it more. It would be good for the English, where I came from. They need it. Like Pink Floyd says, you know, quiet desperation is the English way. So these quiet, desperate people in the London underground, they need to express emotion, but in Israel? And it's really not wise, because the Dharma is very clear. If you, what you feed, that's what will happen. If you feed anger by expressing it, there will be more of it. Whatever you feed, it will increase. So don't feed it, and don't fight it. Allow it in the natural way to be there. Don't suppress it. Don't deny it. Don't do anything with it. It's a natural response, it will come and it will go. And in the eye of awareness, everything loses its power over us. That's a key point. If in the eye of awareness, the awareness has more power and not the thing. We give power to the awareness, we give power to the ocean and not to the wave. So if we look at the wave from the point of view of the ocean, we are the ocean. And the wave has less power over us. We don't need to fight a wave. Let it come, let it go naturally. There's a Zen story which I like. I've told it a few times before, so apologies to the old Vatican here who may have heard it before. But it's of a Zen student that says to his teacher, "I have a real problem with anger. Can you help me deal with it?" And the teacher said, "Sure, no problem. Bring the anger, and we'll deal with it together." And the student said, "Well, right at this moment, I don't have the anger." So the Zen master said, "Well, go home, and when you next have anger, bring it, and we'll deal with it together." And the student said, "Well, yeah, but it takes 10 minutes to go from my room to your room. And in these 10 minutes, the anger will certainly have gone, so how are we going to deal with it?" He said, "You see, even if you want the anger, you can't have it when you want it. It comes and it goes when it wants. So that's the answer. Let it come and let it go when it wants. It's part of the universe. It's not yours." So there's an important lesson in this, that the lesson is that emotion, in a way, comes and goes when it wants, as a result of conditions that we find ourselves in. We don't need to control them, and we don't need to be controlled by them. And this is very important. They come and they go because of conditions in life. We respond in a natural way to conditions in life. And it means we have to allow them to come and allow them to go. And that includes positive emotions. They'll say, "Well, everything you're saying about anger, but I don't want joy to be reduced, or I don't want joy to go. I want it to come, but not to go." But yes, also joy. All of the feelings and emotions, all of them, let them come and let them go. And as William Blake said once, If you kiss the joy as it flies, you live in eternity's sunrise. In other words, Mitzchi, something bigger. We are bigger if we allow even the positive emotions, everything to come and to go, to kiss it as it flies. We bless it, it's great, this joy, but we don't hang on to it. I'd like to read, just as an example, a little piece from Etty Hillerson, where she talks about this, just exactly this point. Etty Hillerson, as you know, maybe know, she was in the Second World War, she wrote a beautiful book, which is just amazing diary of her experiences in Amsterdam in the Second World War with the Gestapo outside. She was a Jewish woman, and she was writing this diary, which is a diary of a great liberated heart with terrible suffering all around her. So I'll just read a small piece just about this issue of emotions. Does that mean I am never sad, that I never rebel, and always give in, and love life, no matter what the circumstances? No, far from it. I believe that I know and share the many sorrows and sad circumstances that a human being can experience. But I do not cling to them. I do not prolong such moments of agony. They pass through me like life itself, as a broad eternal stream. And they become part of that stream, and life continues. If you have given sorrow the space its gentle origins demand, then you may truly say, life is beautiful and so rich. Give the sorrow its space. Give it space. If we give space to our emotional life, and we hold it gently, we don't do anything with it, we don't stop it, we don't put it up, we don't identify. We allow the music of the feelings, and we listen to the music of the feeling life inside us. It's a liberating movement. Firstly, the emotions themselves tend to become, in the space of awareness, they tend to become the more limitless emotions. So, for example, a personal pain in that space can become a kind of sadness of the world, about the world or with the world. We can feel the sadness, which is not a bad thing. It's an emotion which is lifting you up. Love can begin to spread out and become loving kindness and metta. Understanding or pain, the feeling of pain can become compassion. It's giving space to the emotions, allowing the non-identification, but yet not stopping the emotions. Not identifying gives them the space. And then the heart is touched by life and becomes compassion and becomes loving kindness and becomes sometimes sadness and many times great joy. So expanding the emotional life by letting it be free and not locked into the self identification, me and my problems. And the final word, to remember that all thought and emotion is our response to the universe. we are part of the universe. Whether you like it or you don't like it, we are not separate. The universe is in us. We are it. We are made of the same material as the stars, and the earth, and the air. There's no difference. The way we respond to the universe is through thought and through feeling. When we experience something pleasant or unpleasant, we are vibrating with the world. The world is coming in, and we are vibrating, we are touched, we are responding. So there's something about thought and emotion which shows us our connection with the world, our vibrating with the world, our being part of the world. And that's kind of the insight that is part of this sort of liberating movement that comes from being with all these responses rather than against them, and rather than identifying with them, and rather than turning them into problems, just allowing the responses we have with the world to bring us into intimacy with the world and into oneness with the world. Thank you.